Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and it is the 13th of March 2014 and episode 179 of the podcast. Today I have an interview with AJ Hartley, who is both a Shakespeare professor and a thriller author, as well as writing YA and other things. And we talk about adapting Shakespeare to a modern novel, as well as language. And we actually had a real laugh. Andrew's brilliant. So yeah, it was a fantastic interview. I think you'll enjoy it. My big exciting news is that The Deadly Dozen, which is the mystery thriller box set I'm in, so One Day in Budapest is in that box set, along with 11 other amazing books. So it's massive, chunky ebook, for sale, 99 cents. It has hit the New York Times list as well as the USA Today list for the second week. So stunning news. We are all 12 of us now New York Times bestselling authors and USA Today bestselling authors. So very happy about that, and thank you to everyone who bought the book. And it's still available for sale in all ebook stores. So just search for Deadly Dozen Pen, for example, Deadly Dozen P-E-N-N, and you will find it. And I'll be blogging very shortly about some of the lessons learnt about that. So that's my most exciting news, followed rapidly by the fact that it's definitely spring in London. It's sunny and the buds are out on the trees and it's just the flowers are out and it's lovely. Suddenly winter's gone and spring has come. And it's interesting, I make a fuss about this now because I was away for 11 years, 7 in New Zealand and 4 in Australia, and there is no spring in Brisbane, Australia. It's just sort of permanently hot. And so it's really lovely to be seeing the seasons go by, and all kinds of metaphors about our writing life and creativity and things in there, but I'll leave that to you. On writing things, I've started Day of the Vikings, which is just really fun, and will feature Morgan Sierra from the Arcane series and Blake Daniel, my hot psychic guy. He's going to be in it too, and there'll be lots of Viking fun and murder, it's a laugh, really. Yeah, so that's my March project, and yeah, that's about it right now. Lots of exciting things. Planning for the London Book Fair. I will be at the London Book Fair, and I'm considering Thriller Fest. I'm really considering it, just because this box set was basically based on relationships built over years, but started at Thriller Fest and Twitter and podcast and everything. So I guess I am, I think relationships are so important, and going to Thriller Fest will just solidify things, and I'll meet new people and it'll be great. So if you're going to Thriller Fest in New York in July, I may be there. I will be at London Book Fair in April in London, and yeah, lots of I'm doing quite a lot of speaking. If you are in the UK or fancy coming along to something, thecreativepen.com/speaking is the way forward. Okay, the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, so here is a short message from them.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. I wanted to provide a little bit of a tip. I often hear from authors who are already selling well on a particular platform, whether it's Kobo, whether it's Kindle, whether it's Nook, or whether it's Apple. Those tend to be the main places that people are selling. If you're already doing well on one platform, that's great. But consider, there are other platforms out there. And those platforms each come with their own unique sets of customers. So you may be doing well on one platform, but there's a whole world of customers out there available on the other platforms. Yes, I work for Kobo, and of course I want to have your titles in our catalog. But as an author myself, I strongly advise that authors also make their work available in all of the catalogs, because you never know when that customer who's the ideal customer who's going to love your writing and tell all their friends and help spread word about how amazing you are as a writer, you never know what platform they're reading on. And that's why it serves you best to be available across all platforms to get the broadest reach for audience in the world. You can find more tips like this available at KoboWritingLife.com. Do come check us out. And if you're looking at making your work available globally, come to Kobo Writing Life and publish your work directly to Kobo's catalog for 190 countries. I'm Mark Lefebvre from Kobo. Now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with AJ Hartley. Hi Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So just as a little bit of an introduction, Andrew is the New York Times bestselling author of mysteries and thrillers, fantasy, historical fiction, and young adult novels. He's also the Robinson Professor of Shakespeare Studies at the University of North Carolina, which is just amazing. You've got some amazing stuff going on there. So just tell us a little bit more about your writing background and the types of books you write, because it seems to be everything.
Yeah, it is. I sometimes say I have the attention span of a finch. You know, partly because I have a job, I don't feel like I have to build a single reputation as a single kind of novelist. So I write the kind of books I want to write, which invariably means I write the kind of books I want to read. And, you know, like a lot of writers, I read all kinds of different stuff. And because I don't feel like I have to just do one thing. I think my agent would prefer it if I did, I write whatever comes to me.
Mm. And so in terms of your background, did you write books first, or were you an academic first? You know, tell us a bit more about your writing background.
Well, it's a long, tragic story.
The highlights.
The short version is I wrote long fiction for 20 years before I got published. Mm. And this was in the days before self-publishing had really taken off. There wasn't a lot of option, and certainly no ebooks or anything like that. I'm sure if I was doing it now, I would probably go a different route. But yeah, I wrote my first novel when I was 19. I wrote 8 complete books, none of which anybody wanted, which was fairly soul destroying and demoralizing. And of course, you know, I wasn't making any money off this stuff, so I had to have other sources of income. And I was in graduate school and became an academic, and had been, you know, a Shakespeare professor for 10 years before I sold my first novel.
No, it's fascinating to me. And I mean, the academic world is just so different. And I wondered, because of course some of your thrillers are quite commercial, you know, would be described as commercial. So you have this kind of hyper-intelligent stuff going on, and then you've got kind of, not that your thrillers aren't hyper-intelligent. I'm digging here. Anyway, let me start again.
Archaeological of you.
Yes. How do you balance being an academic, like the academic side of your head with the commercial fiction side of your head? How does that work?
I generally have one thing on the front burner at a time. Mm. I tend to sort of focus on one thing at a time, because it is very different and very difficult to switch from being in full creative mode and then switching over to academic, because it's a completely different kind of writing, a different kind of thinking. If I'm working on a novel and I know where it's going, I can do 3,000 words a morning. If I'm writing an academic book or an article, I'm lucky if I can get 500, you know, because every sentence has to be the result of of not just of thought, but of research, and people are going to pounce on anything that you say that isn't right or theoretically grounded or whatever. So yeah, it's a very different thing. It's a little bit more like editing, you know, so that the sort of the thing that I really have to keep separate is the first draft creative stuff. Once I'm in editing mode, once I'm revising and polishing, it gets a little bit more analytical and a little bit closer to the scholarly work, you know. So when I'm in that situation, I could maybe be working on a couple of different projects at the same time. Not like right at the same time, but I can do one in the morning and one in the afternoon or something like that.
It's so interesting. And, I mean, do you enjoy them both in a different way?
I do, he says carefully. creative writing is my first love. You know, I love Shakespeare. I love, and I'm primarily a performance theorist and historian. So I love being in the theater. I love that side of Shakespeare studies. Writing Shakespeare criticism has always been hard for me. It's different, and sometimes I get excited by ideas, and when I feel like I have something really compelling to say or something I think is important, then it's great. I love it. But when I'm trudging through other people's stuff in order to make sure that what I'm saying hasn't been said before or hasn't been proved stupid by somebody else, that can be hard. And sometimes, you know, I find myself thinking, I don't have anything to say about this. I'm trying to write an article on this play and I work on it for weeks. And then I get to the point where I say, do I really have something new to say about this? And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I have little bits of ideas that don't come together in a coherent, unified form. And if that's the case, then I scrap it. Yes, it's different. It's not the same way when you're writing fiction. You can always find a way to make it work, even if there's a part of it is not working for you, in which case maybe you move on to a different project or you turn it into something else. I think for me, it's harder to do that with academic stuff.
It sounds like the inner critic, you know, becomes this exterior critic almost. Academic world is based on critical thinking, isn't it? And yet your thrillers are like, you know, are brilliant in a different way. So I guess how do you balance your, like you talked a bit about ideas there, about getting ideas for stuff. Do you have like two different folders that you keep a kind of fiction ideas and then academic ideas in?
Oh, yeah, they are totally separate. Now, there will be bleed between them, right? I mean, and I, right before we have this conversation, I'm leading a seminar at the Shakespeare Association, which is on Shakespeare and popular fiction, contemporary fiction. So, you know, there are overlaps like that where my creative world gets pulled into my academic world. But even then, it's different because then you're sort of forced to look at it with a completely different set of ideas, and where, you know, I might read a novel that has Shakespearean connections simply for the fun of it or for the thrill of it, for the relationships, for whatever is going on in there. And then when I'm in my academic hat, now it's all sort of sociopolitical and theorized, and let's talk about what it is to adapt Shakespeare. What does that mean? How do we rationalize the impulse to do it in the first place? What version of Shakespeare are we putting out there in the world? So yeah, it's different. But so there's bleed between the two. And obviously, as you said, some of my creative writing does draw on my Shakespeare scholarship, but I think of them as very separate, very different animals.
Yeah, and then so how I kind of discovered you was through Macbeth, which your contemporary version with David Hewson, which actually, yes, as you say, spans both worlds because it is I guess true to the story, but it is a modern interpretation. How would you describe it?
It's tricky because, I mean, it's set kind of in period, sort of medieval Scotland. but it is, the prose is fairly contemporary. I guess it has that sort of Game of Thronesy sort of epic kind of feel, you know, which was deliberate from the outset. That was so. I guess retelling the story as a thriller rather than in the ways that some people think of it as a kind of extended poem or something. And again, because I'm a lot of my background now is in theatre. I mean, my PhD is in English, but a lot of my work is in theatre. We wanted to come to the story from the same kind of perspective that a company might when they're staging it, when they're saying, not how do we get this right, but how do we make it new? How do we find things that interest us within the play and approach the play as the source material for something which is fresh, something which is not simply a retelling of what everybody already knows? So it is, you know, quite adaptive. Not as adaptive as some versions, I suppose, but more than some. And, you know, speaking of that sort of bleed between the two worlds, you know, it's now being written about by academics.
Do they like it, or are they tearing it apart?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know for sure yet. I think a lot of academics are actually writing about this kind of stuff from a very theorized sense of adaptations being a kind of extension of the original rather than a violation of it. You know, that it's an approach to the story which, you know, makes something new rather than is in competition with the original. But I think there are some academics who are always going to sort of look out on any kind of modern adaptation as a kind of corruption or of the original, or a loss of the original, or a loss of things that I value in the original that are not in your version.
Which is crazy. In other words, it's crazy because most people will not read Macbeth in Shakespeare's original. They just won't. Even if they go and see the play, I put myself in that bracket, you know, happy to see the play and like enjoy the theatre, but there's no way I'm going to read it as, you know, a play. And yet your adaptation is brilliant and I recommend it to everybody. I was just going nuts about it when I read it because it brings it to life in such a good way. But I wonder, I think a question I had...
You read it on paper rather than listening to the audio version.
Yes, I did. And I'll come back to the audio in a minute. But one of my questions was, and I know you're an academic and specialist and everything, but can anybody attempt to adapt Shakespeare? As in, it's in the public domain, right? Are there any rules around adapting stuff like that?
No.
You didn't have to ask anyone's permission or anything.
No, you just do it. I mean, that was one of the strange things about... the way that the project came up actually was I had written, I'm in an organization called International Thriller Writers. I don't know if you know of it.
I'm in it too.
Do you ever go to Thriller Fest?
Yeah, I was there 2 years ago, yeah.
I'm not doing it this year, but, and I was there and they had done a collection called The 100 Must Read Thrillers. Mm-hmm. And they'd asked a bunch of thriller writers to write an essay on a thriller that had influenced them. But they specifically asked me if I would do something on Shakespeare as a thriller writer. And I decided to write a little essay on Macbeth. So when that book came out, all the writers were gathered together to do a big signing. And by accident of alphabet, I was sitting next to David Hewson.
Ah, brilliant.
And he had done the introduction to the collection. And at one point he said, so, you know, there must be lots of adaptations of Macbeth. And I said, well, of course. And maybe not, you know. I mean, there have been radical rethinkings of the play. But the idea of something that simply retold the story in period, but as a thriller and made some tweak. No, I mean, as far as we knew, there wasn't something like that. So we said, okay, let's do that. I mean, it was a very bizarre project because within hours of coming up with the idea, we had already pitched it to Audible and it was done in about, I don't know, 6 weeks, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And So it moved very quickly, but yeah, no legal concerns. As you say, it's public domain. I mean, unless something is protected, if it's older than 75 years, right, in US copyright law, then you can have at it.
Yeah, which is amazing, really. And well, then I guess my question commercially, I don't know if you can share this, but has it been like a commercial success? Do people want Macbeth in modern, you know, English?
Well, you know, I mean, it's done very well on Audible. I mean, you know, the audio version, we have well over 1,000 reviews on Audible, which is kind of an amazing thing for an audiobook. And we sold the print rights to Thomas and Mercer, and it has done, yeah, it's done pretty well. I mean, you know, let's put it this way. They're a traditional publisher who are owned by Amazon. When we came back to Audible with the idea for the Hamlet book, which we have coming out in a couple of months, they doubled the advance. So I shouldn't be telling you this, but anyway.
What are they going to do for Romeo and Juliet?
You know, there are, it's funny you should say that, there are a number of new versions of Romeo and Juliet kicking around right now. There's a YA one by Sarah Kane, which I'm just reading. Mm. So, you know, there are a lot of these things out there. And as you say, it's partly because, you know, there's a kind of a built-in hook and no legal, strings.
It is amazing. But no, I read it on the Kindle, but it was originally written for audio, right? So are there specific considerations when you're writing for audiobooks specifically?
Yes, there are. Some of it is simple stuff, like you're assuming that the performance is going to be by a competent actor who's going to be doing all the different voices. So you tend to drop names out of dialogue, for example, because the voice is going to, you know, is going to do that for you. You don't need as many adverbial tags in speech. You know, you don't need to say he whispered angrily because we just heard it, right? In the little snatch of dialogue. So those kind of things, I think it changes your attitude a little bit to how you use large passages of description and the kind of stuff, the way you write action. I mean, it's the same as when you read a manuscript aloud to yourself and you hear things differently than when you're simply reading it on the page. So, you know, you have to kind of get used to that. And then if the project then turns into a print book as well, sometimes you have to go back in and tweak to make what the actors work visible on the page where you don't have the actual actor. With the Macbeth, we were lucky in that we had Alan Cumming who did the performance, and he's a Scot. So one of the other things that we got in that was that because our version was very Scottish in some ways, in ways that Shakespeare's isn't, that it was very sort of saturated in the landscape and in the place names and so on. And it was nice to be able to hear that done by somebody who sounds like he knows what he's talking about, just because that's where he comes from, you know, and it's there in his own dialect. And he doesn't stumble over the words. There's nothing worse. I will not go into details, but there's nothing worse than listening to audiobooks and having people, we were talking about dialect before, you know, people doing versions of British dialect and somebody's supposed to be from Wales and they sound like Dick Van Dyke doing a geeky Cockney Sparrow. Oh, it just makes me.
Oh, it's funny though, because I write kind of international thrillers, and I've just done an Audible ACX a thing and got people to audition. And my book One Day in Budapest has a lot of Hungarian names in, and of course I don't know how they're meant to be pronounced. So I'm listening, going, I don't know if that's right, but you know, it sounds vaguely yes. Eastern European. But probably someone's going to come back and go, "There's no way that's a Hungarian accent. That's like a Polish accent."
Yeah. I mean, you know, you deal with as much of that kind of stuff as you can and hope for the best.
Hope for the best. It's interesting. So you obviously, you've talked about writing in a different way. So obviously the language that you use when you write academic stuff is different to commercial thrillers. And I think that your, you know, the Macbeth and Hamlet is kind of in the middle. I would say it's a higher class of language. So it's probably, I want to call it literary fiction, but I also want to say as a reader of thrillers, it's more engaging than a lot of literary fiction.
Thank God.
Yeah, so let's not call it literary fiction. Let's call it a thriller.
I mean, sometimes people call it historical fiction, and that has some overtones of literary quality.
Yeah, but I think, and I keep going on about this, but I found the pace of a Shakespeare, it just was incredibly fast considering what most people assume the book would be like.
Right.
Anyway, my question is, as someone who plays with language like you do, do you have a sort of recommendation for people like me, you know, writers earlier on in their career, for improving language skills like that, other than reading Shakespeare in the original?
That's a really good question. I think you're right that you don't have to read Shakespeare, but I think that reading anything that challenges your own sense of how words work, to read outside the genre in which you're most comfortable. And, you know, I would say, this is going to sound weird, but I think you can learn a lot from reading poetry.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because poetry is all about language, and it's usually short and dense. And that sometimes, I think, is what we sometimes lack when we're writing genre fiction, that it becomes all about narrative, it becomes all about scene and action, and the sentence level stuff kind of gets a little bit lost. And I'm not suggesting you write purple prose, or it becomes very sort of self-consciously precious or literary. But I think that sort of awareness of what language can do economically, right? That's one of the great things about poetry, that it has a kind of density, or it can have a density. So it's not like you're using a lot of words. Often you're using fewer words, but you're using them in slightly surprising, precise ways that make the reader see something or feel something a little more acutely, that surprise them in some ways, so that what might feel potentially formulaic or predictable can jar you out of it and make you see something that you would otherwise go right by, you know? And I think there's value to that. And it's certainly something that I'm doing a lot of YA, of young adult writing at the moment, and it seems to be particularly valued there, where a lot of publishers seem to be saying that what they're looking for is genre fiction. In other words, very story-driven, but which feels literary on a sentence level,
yeah.
where it feels like there's a little more weight, a little more thought. And, I mean, as you read sometimes, and I think thrillers are a particular danger with this, that you read thrillers sometimes and they feel like screenplays, you know, that there's a sort of mechanical simplicity to the writing, which is serviceable, but it misses opportunities.
Mm. No, I'm glad you say that. I'm doubly glad you say that, because I have Charles Bukowski and Anne Sexton on my desk.
Well, you can't go wrong there, then.
Yeah, try and mix it up there with those two. Well, no, it's great you say that. Now, just coming back on the International Thriller Writers, which, you know, I said I'm a member of as well, I wondered, like, as a career writer, have you found that the relationships through organisations like that have been really important, and do you advise authors to get into those type of things?
That's a good question. You know, ITW is a wonderful organisation. The conference is expensive. And I'm able to do stuff like that in part because the nature of my position means that a lot of those kinds of expenses I can cover through my school budget. And I would probably have thought twice about doing it otherwise. But there's no question that connections that I have made through ITW have helped my career. You know, I mean, with my early thrillers, I have, you know, blurbs, quotes on the back from Steve Barry, from David Morrell, from Douglas Preston. You know, big name authors as thriller writers, right? When I was pitching my my middle grade series, the Darwin Arkwright, the first of the Darwin Arkwright series, I was able to approach the publisher with the manuscript before it was sold, with a blurb from R.L. Stine, the yeah. Goosebumps author, who I had met through ITW, you know, and who incredibly generously agreed to read the manuscript and gave me notes, you know. I mean, yeah, there's no question that it helped me.
Yeah, and I would second that. I just think it's phenomenal to meet these people. And, you know, even talking with you, we've met through a connection through ITW well. So it's just brilliant. Yeah, so I also wanted to ask you, because obviously, you know, you've been doing this a while now, and you know, you mentioned Thomas and Mercer, which is a relatively new publishing house from Amazon, self-publishing. You know, what do you think of the current state of affairs right now? And, you know, do you have any recommendations for people earlier on in the process?
I mean, it's tough right now. I mean, I think in some ways there are a lot of opportunities out there for people because the landscape is so uncertain, and that there are a lot of people, you know, breaking out of the conventional modes through self-publishing or through small presses, who are doing very well, you know, or at least doing well enough. Though, of course, they have to shoulder more responsibility in terms of publicity and marketing and things like that. But it's also true that a lot of the traditional publishers do not provide the support for mid-list authors. And the mid-list is very, very large these days, it seems to me, that people tend to expect. That a lot of support goes to people at the very top end. And most of the people, it's a little bit sink or swim. Your book goes out, and if it doesn't do very well very quickly, people quickly forget about it and forget about you. So I think and you're only as good as your last book. And by good, I don't mean the quality of the book, of course. I mean how well it sold. Barnes & Noble here, I think some people thought that they were going to be out of business within the next year or so. I don't think that's going to happen. They've had, you know, issues with the Nook and with their online sales compared to Amazon, but the physical stores themselves seem to be doing okay. And I think people are still buying a lot of physical books in physical stores. And so long as that continues to be true, the power of the big five publishers, I think, is going to be significant. So I guess I would still advise people to shoot for those if they can, you know, but there is more than one way of doing it. I mean, you know, when I was starting out, I didn't do conferences. I didn't go to conventions, and there was no self-publishing or anything like that. I'd write a manuscript. I'd send it off, sit around for months waiting for everybody in the world to reject it, and then start another manuscript. And that's one of the reasons it took me as long as it did to get published. It doesn't have to be like that now. And you can obviously, you can attract attention from, even if you are shooting for a big publishing house, you can attract their attention in all kinds of ways. One of them is by being in person at these kind of conventions, meeting with agents, meeting with editors. Another way is by getting your stuff out there where people can see it. I mean, we're constantly seeing in Publishers Weekly and so on accounts of somebody who's landed a big deal because they had sold X number of thousand copies that they had self-pubbed, you know. I still think that for most writers at the moment, a traditional press is going to get them more visibility than self-publishing, because a lot of self-publishing, unless you're really good at the marketing and you have a good product like you, you know, you can attract a lot of attention that way. A lot of self-pub authors go into it thinking that they're going to be wildly successful and learn very quickly that it, you get lost. I sometimes say, you know, Amazon is like the warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? You know, where this sort of infinite expanse of identical boxes. And in some ways it's wonderful because there's so much stuff there, but how on earth do you find it? How do you discover it? How do you, how do people know it even exists when it's lost? I mean, a few years ago, if I had a book, like an academic book, say, that was not selling at all on Amazon, it would slide down into the sort of 3 million sales ranking, 4 million. That same book now, if nobody's buying it, that'd be like 12 million.
Really?
Yeah. Within the space of a couple of years. And that's just volume increase.
Yeah. Well, I would also say, I was going to ask you about academic publishing specifically, because there seems to be, I mean, like, my husband is a statistician and he buys these textbooks. They're like £50 for a textbook. Yeah. So I think pricing is a big issue for academic publishing. But also it just seems like there's just a lot of more upheaval in academic, because you have to publish as an academic, right? So how do you think the upheaval in self-publishing and everything will translate into academic publishing?
Well, as is often the case in academia, everything moves very slowly. Mm. But it's going to happen. It's going to have to happen. I mean, I have a book on the performance history of Julius Caesar, which is coming out in a month, which I'm sure everybody will be very excited about.
Yeah, desperate for that one.
And, you know, it just came up on Amazon, and the list price is £85. Yeah. You know, it's like, and it's in hardcover, and it's Manchester University Press. And I said, okay, so when is this going to be out in paperback? Oh, in a year or two. So what that means is they're assuming that nobody will buy the book except university libraries.
And why do they have to pay £85?
Well, but that means also that your print run is going to be like 500 copies.
Yeah.
You know, and the chances of it selling more than that are very, but it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. You know, if you get an ebook or something out there for a couple of bucks, frankly, there's no need for it to be more expensive than that, then suddenly you have the potential to reach a much wider audience. And academic presses have just not got on board with this yet. And part of the problem is that many of them that are university presses have been considered part of the educational wing of the university. So they're subsidized. And the assumption is, you know, we're getting books out into libraries and that's it. But increasingly, as funding has got a lot tighter in universities, and those presses are having to lay people off and they're finding all their budgets are disappearing, they're going to have to find ways to get their stuff out there. Plus, a lot of libraries don't have the money anymore. Libraries are not going to spend £85 on a book. They're going to switch over to ebooks. And if your book doesn't exist as an electronic version, forget it. It's going to go away.
Mm. So why, as the author, did you get commissioned to write that book, or do you have to go through an academic press because you are an academic? I mean, would you consider self-publishing that, and then your class could buy it for a fiver?
If all I was trying to do was get the book out there so that people could read it, then I might consider that. But the fact is that in academia, people are acutely conscious of who's publishing your book. And some of it, it's not simply about status. It's about gatekeeping and it's about vetting quality, right? And if I self-publish a book, then people have to actually read it cover to cover before they can decide whether it's any good or not. If I publish that book with Cambridge University Press, then people know that that book has been vetted very carefully by experts in the field before I was ever given a contract. And that I've worked with editors who are, you know, who are up to speed on the subject before it ever sees the light of day. So some of that is about quality control. And also, I mean, it doesn't matter so much for me because I can't be promoted any further. But if I was coming up for tenure or something, it would make a huge difference. If I somebody has a book from Cambridge UP or another reputable academic press, and somebody else has published a book by themselves, a self-pub book, the tenure committees, they're not going to take it seriously. Even if the stuff is good, because you've got to demonstrate that, you know, that it was published because it was good rather than because it was done.
And this it seems to come down to definition of success. So within academic publishing, like you say, it is about having a publication on your history as an academic. And yet with your thrillers, it would probably be more commercial number of books sold, I suppose. And yeah. and Thomas and Mercer is not a famous publisher yet.
No. But, I mean, that's the thing. You know, when I was being... when I was last being promoted, the school said, "So you'll just write when you produce your personal narrative and CV." And they said, "Well, you know, we assume you're just going to write about your Shakespeare stuff." And I said, "Yeah." And then I thought about it and I said, "Wait a minute! Every time I publish a novel, it gets sent out to the trustees of the university. I'm doing signed copies for people. It's in the newspaper. My university affiliation is always there." I'm an asset to the school as a creative writer as well as an academic. So no, I'm going to include my creative writing in my packet. And they said, okay, but you somehow will have to unify those things in order to make it coherent. So I did, but you know, part of my argument was, look, if an academic book that I have will be read by, I mean, let's be honest, maybe the print run is 500 or something, or maybe it's 1,000, but most academic books are going to be read by 20 or 30 people because academia is so sub-specialized. Not that many people are going to really read it. Now, if one of my thrillers is being read by 150,000 people, then, you know, there's value to that, right? And I can say, look, so it's not like I'm not doing the academic stuff. It's not that I'm not doing traditional critical analysis and scholarship. I'm doing that. But I also have this other stuff over here, which reaches far more people.
Yeah.
And there is crossover between what I'm doing. Some of the things that interest me as a scholar find their ways into my fiction and vice versa. So, you know, I position myself now as a sort of hybrid, you know, somewhere in between the two, and that's who I am, and the school where I'm at now seems happy with that, so that's good.
Yeah, and I mean, just coming full circle back to right at the beginning, I mean, you use the same name for everything you do. Is that a problem? Yeah. I mean, do you struggle with the branding issue there? I mean, when I click on your author page on Amazon, it is a little bit confusing because I find books I'm like, yeah, great. And then, like, you know, really difficult title.
Yeah. I mean, technically, I mean, my academic critical work, my scholarly stuff is published under Andrew James Hartley.
Right.
My creative work comes out as AJ Hartley. The difference is negligible. And yeah, it's confusing. But I mean, as you said at the beginning, part of my issue also is that it's not that I only write one kind of novel. I write lots of different kinds of novel, and they all come out under AJ Hartley, which incidentally, you know, was not my decision in the first place. That was a decision made by an editor at Penguin because the protagonist of my first book was a woman and I wasn't. Mm. So they called me AJ. I never asked for that. Yeah, exactly.
That's so funny. I love that. It's the same with all of us with initials. I went with JF because people said my writing was too masculine.
What does that even mean?
No? It means I like violence.
But seriously, in this day and age, anyway. Yes, so yeah, no, but you're right, it is a branding problem for me. That, you know, somebody said you need a slogan for your website, and I'm like,
I do everything.
Good night, fun books for smart people.
That's awesome. I want to see that. I want to see that.
But no, I mean, I'm all over the place, and that's an issue.
It's an issue, but a good issue, because I think it's brilliant. It means that people will try different things of your stuff, and it makes you really interesting. So,
well, I mean, and this is also something that is helped by the online marketplace, because it's different going into a Barnes & Noble or any physical store and looking in one section and then walking across the store to find my stuff that's in fantasy or in YA or in children's or whatever. But on Amazon, it's all there. You search by author and everything just lines up right in front of you. So I wonder if the shift to the electronic marketplace will actually increase people's connection as readers to authors regardless of genre, rather than, you know, going into the thriller section and saying, okay, who's next to Lee Child? Fine. You know?
Yeah, I hope so too. Right, so you better tell us, tell everybody about your latest books or what you've got coming out in, you know, in each of those things.
In each of those things. Well, the next thing I have coming out is the novel of Hamlet, which is very imaginatively called Hamlet, a Novel.
which I will be getting because I loved Macbeth. Fantastic.
Excellent. And it was done as an audio deal. Like the Macbeth, it's done as an audio deal first. We haven't sold it as a print book yet. The audio book is performed by Richard Armitage, who a lot of people will know as Thorin Oakenshield from the Hobbit movies, among other things. And he's wonderful. So that comes out May 20th, and then hopefully it will come out in print, but probably not for another year or so. And at the moment, that's all I have. I mean, I have other academic stuff, which nobody cares about, coming out this year. But I'm currently working on a YA novel which is set in a kind of Victorian Africa.
Dr. Livingstone, I presume.
something like that. I mean, it's about
And tell people about your latest thriller, since I'm a thriller author too.
My most recent thriller was Tears of the Jaguar, which is set mainly in Mexico, and also involves Lancashire witchcraft from the 17th century, which is where I'm from. Tears of the Jaguar was my last.
Yeah, brilliant. So where can people find you and your books online?
My website is ajhartley.net. And of course they can find me on Amazon and hopefully wherever books are sold, as they used to say.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Andrew. I really enjoyed our chat.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.